The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
We have one case for this afternoon. It's number 20-1382, Liquid Inc. v. L'Oreal USA Inc. Mr. Kinnaird, obviously many of the issues that were briefed here were resolved in our opinion about the injunction, but there are some remaining issues. Mr. Kinnaird, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Your Honor. I plan to address J-Mall on the trade secret and contract claims, the witness exclusion error, the written description issue that would end the patent claims, and damages. Olaplex asserted...
Well, let's begin with the substitution issue, which you didn't mention, the standing issue.
Your Honor, I think our understanding of the 954 decision of this court, which held that that substitution of a transferee was available, notwithstanding mootness, would seem to us to resolve this case as well. Olaplex asserted four categories.
That's nice that you're taking that position, but I'm not sure that the previous opinion does resolve that issue, because in that case, we said that the transfer took place after the judgment had occurred. Are you agreeing that that same thing happened here with respect to the money damages?
No, the transfer here occurred after final judgment. So the case was moot at the time of final judgment. So we think that it was moot, but the court distinguished the Bain case, which had held that there's no remedy while joinder or dismissal of party if there's Article III standing is permissible, but not substitution if there's mootness, and the court, at least as I understood the opinion, said that you could substitute if it's a transferee as opposed to a brand new party.
Okay.
So that remedy is available, and the court could order it, I think, in line with the others. But if the court believes that's distinguishable, then I think then there is a potential distinction in terms of when judgment was rendered, and that there was lack of standing here at the time of judgment.
Okay, well, unless my colleagues have further questions about that, why don't you just go ahead?
Yes, Your Honor. Olaplex asserted four categories of trade secrets at trial. Three cannot even arguably sustain the verdict, as the district court ruled, and critically, there's zero evidence of improper use or causation of damages.
Mr. Kinnaird, can I just double-check something? And this is perhaps more important question to Olaplex. Is there a dispute about whether there's any difference relevant to this case in the legal requirements for the trade secret and contract breach claims?
The distinction they point out is that they don't have to show value, but they do have to show that the contract, that the information to be protected by the contract was not generally available, which is the same as ready ascertainability, and was not previously possessed by or independently developed by L'Oreal USA. And if that's true, there is no protection at all. And because their theory is use and breach of a duty under the NDA, there's no misappropriation. So I think in practical terms, there is no difference. You can't sustain the verdict on the contract because they have the same flaws in proof. And the patent application that they asserted can't be a trade secret.
Counsel, this is Judge Rayner. When you say the same flaws in proof, do you mean economic value or showing of economic value in both of those instances?
No, Your Honor. I think that it's not the value that it's, but the value has to be derived by not being readily ascertainable or generally known. And that's in common with the contract requirement that it can't, that the information can't be generally available. And so here is the thing, and I think Olaplex now concedes, they, at trial, they disclaimed any trade secret that was a combination of public and private information at pages 13 to 15 to 16 of the trial transcript, which rules out the unpublished patent application as a whole. So they now concede at page 21 of the red brief, and as the Third Circuit held in Heisley, a plaintiff must identify discrete non-public information contained in the application and prove that it qualifies as a trade secret. But Olaplex never asserted any narrow maleic acid trade secret at trial. Neither the district court's conception of a maleic acid active ingredient nor Olaplex's appellate redefinition of its secret as maleic acid used during bleaching. And indeed, it couldn't have. The Mintel reference addressed during prosecution disclosed a bleaching cream with maleic acid. Olaplex distinguished it only by adding a concentration limitation, appendix 14-285-86. And the PTAB, as the court knows, found that Ogawa, KR-564, and Kitabata disclosed maleic acid during bleaching. This court upheld those findings. But if Olaplex wished...
Is the standard determining whether something is obvious the same as the trade secret standard about public availability or ability to reconstruct the trade secret from public
sources? Your Honor, they're not exactly the same, but they share certain commonality. If anything, obviousness is harder, as to show reasonable expectation of success and the like. But ready ascertainability is, I think, a lower standard and doesn't apply to the entire invention. It's whatever the trade secret is, which they defined as maleic acid during bleaching, at least on appeal.
This is just Toronto. Do you need that proposition here? I had understood that once one focuses on the asserted trade secret of maleic acid, either as an active ingredient or during bleaching, that at least one, maybe two, maybe three or four individual pieces of prior art teach that, even if obviousness was needed for the entirety of the particular claims in the two PGRs.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I'd like to point out, though, this was part of their affirmative burden of proof, and they put on no expert who surveyed the public literature and testified that use of maleic acid during bleaching was not readily ascertainable or generally known. And that failure of proof alone requires JMAL. But as you point out, we also put forth multiple references disclosing maleic acid during bleaching. Olaplex studiously ignored them in its red brief, looked to other ones that we just had in there for the functional effects of maleic acid. And as we show at pages 33 to 34, this is, I think, very clearly determined, even if, you know, even apart from their failure on the burden of proof. But JMAL should be granted for an independent and simple reason. There can be no misappropriation or breach of contract unless the NDA protected the information transmitted, there's no protection if L'Oreal previously possessed or independently developed it. As shown in the blue brief at 27 to 28, the record incontrovertibly shows that L'Oreal possessed the alleged trade secret of maleic acid used during bleaching by at least April 16, 2015, a month before. The PTAB found that. This court in the 954 appeal affirmed. And because that's so, none of the so-called circumstantial evidence advanced by Olaplex, which is conspiracy theory masquerading as proof, matters, because we are not restricted in using the putative trade secret information if we already possessed it, and there can be no misappropriation or breach of contract. But I would point out, Your Honor, that even absent JMAL, the exclusion of critical witnesses warrants a new trial. Alar was the central fact witness to our defense.
Can I just ask you this question? What document do you think Olaplex should have served on whom in order to seek a deposition of Ms. Allard?
Well, Your Honor, they really didn't have any way to get a compulsory There's no compulsory deposition. What they had notice that had to be filed, they could have come to us and requested it, right? And then, but the other important point, I would say, you know,
wait, just hold on a second. So your view is that under the district court's order, it was the burden was on them to seek and take the deposition rather than to your offering up the witnesses. Is that right?
Well, our view is that the scheduling order doesn't have anything to do with duty.
Try to answer my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is your view that under the scheduling, you listed the witnesses, so in that respect you complied. Is it your view that having listed the witnesses, it was up to them to depose them rather than up to you to offer them up for deposition?
Right, Your Honor, there's never a duty to offer to for deposition. I mean, even if it's within the a witness within your control, you have to notice the deposition. They didn't do that with Alar.
So I'm a little confused. I thought you just said there wasn't actually any compulsory process that Olaplex had available to it that it bypassed to get Alar's deposition, and that what Olaplex should have done is simply say, please, would you do it for us?
Yes, they could have asked, but because the important point is the established law is that a party has no duty to produce anyone for deposition other than an officer, director, or managing agent, and then only upon notice. And the scheduling order did and could not impose new discovery duties. It only declares that it is expected that witnesses will have been disclosed, vetted, and deposed if a party elects during the fact discovery process. So as befits a scheduling order, this means only that if a party elects to depose a trial witness and is entitled to the deposition, it has to schedule it before fact discovery closes. And this is another fundamental point. If Olaplex believed that its September 2018 Hague request was, quote, an election that triggered a duty of L'Oreal USA to produce Alar, then as with any enforcement of a discovery obligation, it had to meet and confer, and if necessary, file a motion to compel production of Alar for deposition before the December 21st fact discovery deadline. Olaplex cannot wait 9 months and then raise its novel theory of a scheduling order violation for the first time in a motion in limine and then say our prior offer of a deposition came too late. And further, I think Olaplex is responsible for how it frames its discovery request. It sought Alar or another witness as a corporate deponent for L'Oreal S.A. And it's not really our role or duty to suggest that their Hague request was an ill-conceived mechanism for deposing Alar, who was not present in France, and inquire whether they might, you know, affirmatively inquire whether they might prefer a more limited deposition on her personal knowledge. And so
when Olaplex filed its Hague Convention request, did you already know that Alard was in South America and not in France?
Yeah, they did too, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because it was mentioned in their expert report. But yes, she's there, been there since 2016. And by the way, even if they feel like they should have gotten her then, we offered her right within a week. They said, arrange it through us, and we sent a letter even a week after that. So there was no prejudice at all. But even so, in the absence of duty, the district court...
Hold on a second. Unless my colleagues have further questions on the witness issue, I'd like to turn you to the effect of the PTAB decision on your invalidity contentions as to the patent verdict.
Yes.
So are we done with the witness questions?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So you had these two invalidity issues that you raised, written description and obviousness. And why is it that the PTAB decision, which has now become final, isn't preclusive as to those two because they could have been raised in the post-grant review proceeding?
Your Honor, the reason is twofold. One is that this statute says that estoppel comes when there is a final written decision under Section 328A. That's the PTAB final written decision. So when the 954 final written decision was issued before trial, this estoppel issue was ripe. And they chose, for their strategic reasons, not to assert it in the district court. And so the purpose of the statutory estoppel was frustrated because we had to go ahead and try that. And I think they may have done that because they knew in the very limited time we'd have to put on that case and it would detract from our other arguments.
Let's assume for the moment that we were to hold that the estoppel doesn't arise until the final written decision becomes final, i.e. not subject to further court review. They weren't untimely if that's the case, right?
They wouldn't be untimely, Your Honor. The problem with that interpretation also is it's a fact question about what we reasonably could have raised. And here, in regard to written description, our written description defense was based on the district court's claim construction, which postdated the PGR petition. And they certainly haven't established that. And there's no mechanism on appeal to really determine that or to determine whether the references we relied on in obviousness were the same. So I think it has to be...
I'm sorry, I just didn't understand what you're saying.
Take
written description.
Right.
You could have raised that before the PTAB, right?
We could have, yes.
So why isn't there foreclosure as to that?
Well, the reason is the foreclosure, it wasn't the precise written description defense, because our written description defense necessarily had to address the district court's claim construction, and one of the primary disputes was whether, among other things, that the breakage descriptions actually reflected what the district court had deemed to be industry standard testing, which was only part of their construction. So we couldn't have raised the precise defense. We could have raised a written description defense, but I think that's the issue, that it would have been their burden to prove. And I think, Your Honor, that because that's a factual question, that simply underscores why.
Would I understand correctly that the implication of your position, what you just said, is that not just as to written description, but as to enablement, indeed, in IPRs, as to 102-103, if a district court adopts a particular claim construction, along the way, that a whole bunch of 102, 103, 112 defenses now are not subject to estoppel because it's not exactly the same claim construction as the board used?
I think it would be case by case, Your Honor. It may be that the defenses
like
are not affected.
Extraordinary narrowing of,
right,
of the estoppel provision.
And that's why I say I think it would have to be one in which the written description defense was affected by the position. But I think that's the plain language. Under 315, the PTAB has taken the position that estoppel arises with its final written decision, even prior to rehearing or prior to appeal. And I think this is not written like some of the other provisions which have to do with cancellation, which talk about a final ruling, and they didn't use the term of art, final written decision under 328A. So I think if the court reaches it, I'm well into my rebuttal, I think, and passed. Would you like to hear argument on either the substance of written description or damages?
Well, have you said all you have to say about the PTAB estoppel issue?
Yes.
Okay. We'll give you a minute to talk about the merits of written description and obviousness.
Not damages. That's fine. The written description, what they had to describe was the precise invention of claims 14 to 16, which is the specific bleaching method of claim 13 with maleic acid in a specified concentration range, second application of maleic acid as a conditioning agent, and then resulting in the enumerated breakage reductions. And the specification doesn't describe that for three reasons. First, the breakage reductions are only described for some embodiments, not identified maleic acid, as opposed to the potentially thousands of other active agents that are covered by the patent's generic formulas. None of the breakage reductions is identified for bleaching, much less the specific bleaching method of Claim 13. In fact, the sections in which those disclosures are made deal with permanent waving and hair coloration. And third, the specification must describe the full range of the claim up to 100% breakage reduction. There's no description of a perfect method of hair protection that eliminates 100% of breakage, but Olaplex claims that. So it's unfounded, and we clearly did preserve the issue in Rule 50A. Counsel, we identified the law, written description. We identified the facts, the testimony of Dr. Freeman. And the district court had said, don't give me argument, and then ruled summarily. So we think that issue is presented.
Okay, I think unless my colleagues have further questions about this issue, we're out of time. Not hearing any questions. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Weisburst.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to begin briefly with the question of jurisdiction. It is our position that this court should decide that question based both on the decision and the injunction appeal that Mr. Kinnaird referenced, but also because the transfer here did occur after the judgment. Specifically, the judgment was rendered in mid-December, and the transfer happened in January. And that we've explained that in our brief, why that is so. Only the final judgment paper, not the final judgment, occurred after the judgment was entered.
Okay. The problem with that, perhaps, is that the December document is not labeled judgment. And some of these cases have suggested that in determining whether something constitutes a judgment, that it really depends on the district court's intent. I'll tell you what troubles me a bit about that argument is that if instead of a standing issue, we had here a question of the timeliness of the notice of appeal, to say that you had to appeal from something that's labeled a memorandum opinion and order or whatever it was, seems to me potentially unfair. What's your answer to that?
Yes, I think that the answer to that comes from the federal rules, and specifically there is a normal requirement that a final judgment paper, which as Your Honor referenced is something that states that it is a judgment on its face, is. However, if a party goes ahead and files a notice of appeal earlier than that, then that requirement of a final judgment paper and waiting, I believe it's 120 days until that happens, is waived under the federal rules.
Okay, the problem that I'm having is if we call this original memorandum the final judgment, then you would have to appeal from that document within the time period, and that's potentially unfair, right?
No, I don't.
We were just talking about the question of whether that, in the context of the timeliness of a notice of appeal, whether it would be unfair to treat this memorandum as the final judgment. So, Mr. Weisberg,
And very briefly, I believe that absent the fact that L'Oreal did go ahead and file a notice of appeal, this would not be an issue of fairness because you would have the normal requirement of a separate final judgment paper that would be required. So I don't believe it presents unfairness.
That seems to suggest that you're arguing for a different standard for substitution and for the notice of appeal as to when the final judgment is.
What I'm saying is the final judgment in fact did occur. I believe that to the extent that Schreiber holds on this issue, I don't intend to criticize Schreiber during today's argument, but to the extent Schreiber is a holding,
are you saying that if the notice of appeal were only filed from what's labeled here as the final judgment, that would be timely?
if L'Oreal had not filed an earlier notice of appeal in January and instead had waited for a final judgment paper to file its notice of appeal, yes, our position is that would be timely. However, final judgment would still final. I think the distinction is between final judgment on the one hand and the final judgment paper on the other. It is our position that the final judgment was as of December, and therefore the transfer took place after. However, even if Your Honor and this court rejects all of that, we do believe that under the approach of the injunction appeal, which has now remanded and held that there's jurisdiction to have a new trial on liability for patent infringement, that also should control here. It wouldn't make much sense to dismiss the damages piece of the case and make that start over when we know we're going to have a new liability trial for injunction purposes. If I could turn to the question of the trade secret JMAL issue, we absolutely do not concede that the trade secret was public information.
Did you have any testimony at all on the question of whether it was readily ascertainable? I'm talking about the maleic acid.
Yes, we did. Our expert, and there is some overlap.
Where did your expert testify that it wasn't readily ascertainable?
Dr. Borish was our principal expert on this issue, as well as Mr. Shun. But Dr. Borish testified to all of the prior art references that were raised by L'Oreal at trial.
I'm asking you where he testified to this point.
Yes, I can. If you bear with me, I can give you the appendix site. So, for example, it's at around 45566 and thereabouts.
Which volume?
If we're bullish under, this is the appendix.
Which volume?
Volume 4. Volume 4 actually begins with 45564, so he goes on and talks about several different references at that point. And, yes, he's doing it in the context of obviousness.
Wait, you're not answering the question. Where did he testify that it wasn't readily ascertainable? I understand that he attempted to distinguish some of these references. Where does he testify that the alleged trade secret wasn't readily ascertainable?
For example, if we look at 45566, he argues that there's kind of two schools of prior art,
Wait, what page?
45566.
Okay. Where?
And this is just one example, but he's talking about teaching away and how some of the prior art references involved a high pH and others involved a low pH, and it was his position that they couldn't be combined, and it was not obvious to combine them, and it was not, therefore, as a matter of trade secret, readily ascertainable to combine them.
When does he say that on?
Well, I'm not sure he used the words readily ascertainable on that specific page. But he did certainly use the concept of teaching away, and I would argue that teaching away is means it's not readily ascertainable. We also, however,
this is testimony about obviousness, right?
That's right. We also, if I could just provide the court with another citation, this is from Mr. Shun, who was more the trade secret expert. Although the reason I talk about obviousness is because that's where a lot of the prior art references were discussed at trial. But Mr. Shun at 44624 to 44625 discussed the value of the trade secrets and they're not being readily ascertainable.
Okay.
And I'll give
what page?
44624 to 44625.
Okay, which line?
Well, I think we could start with line 16 on 44624. Where he talks about the use of maleic acid in a bleaching treatment at the same time as a bleaching treatment as being a brand new category in the industry.
He testified that it wasn't readily ascertainable from the prior art references.
So if we look at the following page, 44625, he says that these are very unconventional methods that were being used by Olaplex and they had not been used before. But I would, if the court will permit me, I do want to point out that a couple of things. Number one, even if the obviousness and the readily ascertainable standard were exactly the same, we do now have a PTAB decision affirmed by this court that says that claims 14 through 16 of the 954 patent are not obvious. We would argue it follows a fortiori that those can sustain a trade secret. And the reason why those claims alone are not...
Where did you claim that those... that was the trade secret? I thought the trade secret, as defined in your brief, was the use of maleic acid in the bleaching process.
Yes, that is what we said in the brief. At the time, we had not yet lost the independent claims of those patents. And we stand by that position, I want to stress, because the standard of obviousness under patent law is different from the standard for trade secret purposes under the Supreme Court's Kewanee decision. But I think we've been focusing a lot on the unpublished patent application, but it's equally important to focus on what else was handed over the table on May 19th that L'Oreal misused. And that was a set of financial information and how to test and know how for producing this product and bringing it to market. There were
Mr. Weisberg, this is Judge Serrano. Can I just ask you the same question I asked Mr. Kinnaird? Is there any difference relevant to this case in the legal requirements for the trade secret and contract breach claims?
Well, I would agree with Mr. Kinnaird. I think the main difference is the value of the trade secret, that we don't need to prove value for purposes of the breach of contract claim. We do need to prove that for the trade secret claim we believe we have. I would agree with Mr. Kinnaird, though, that in terms of whether something was publicly available or not, if it really were publicly available, it wouldn't be protected by the contract. But we absolutely showed that this was not publicly available here. And
I don't remember you're making an argument about a difference in the existence or strength of a particularity requirement, which has a fair bit of precedent in the trade secret area, and I didn't know whether you thought that carried over to the contract claim, but I don't remember you making any distinction on that ground.
No, we did not argue that. We pointed to the value. But I would like to say, so there, we had this testimony from the Olaplex CEO, Mr. Crystal. He explained that they had given not just the unpublished patent application, but also financial information and technical know-how and dead ends and how to bring this product to market. And that full package of material is what's at issue here. So it's really not just one unpublished patent application. And I heard Mr. Kinnaird criticize this as masquerading and CEO hyperbole, he called it in his brief. But really what this was competing presentations to a jury which decided this issue. And it's a very high standard, as this court knows, to overturn a jury verdict. And we don't think that that standard has been met. Now, I would like to briefly point the court to a few citations.
I'm a little confused about something you just said, and I just may have misunderstood. You referred to a package. Is there a document that you're referring to as identifying the trade secrets other than the maleic acid one, that the know-how testing that you said that your expert or your witness was referring to and thereby incorporating some details that he might not have articulated in answers to questions as a witness?
Well, again, the key witness here is Mr. Shun, who sort of ties everything together. But he does refer to all of the material that was handed over at that May 19th meeting, which included both the unpublished application as well as financial information.
Well, the problem with that is that the cases suggest that you have to identify a trade secret with some particularity, and that sounds just like saying, well, it's this document and maybe some of the material in it is a trade secret. There isn't any specificity as to what the trade secret is other than the maleic acid trade secret that you assert.
Yes, and to clarify my point, the trade secret is maleic acid used at the same time and after a bleaching treatment. This other material, such as the financial information, the technical know-how, surrounds that trade secret and is what helps make it a valuable trade secret.
What's the other trade secret? I mean, it hasn't been defined is the problem.
It's, well, I, you know, I point the court to the 44624 of the appendix. The trade secret there is defined as a maleic-based treatment in bleaching. Mr. Schunze, that is the trade secret.
I'm not talking about the maleic acid trade secret. I'm talking about the other alleged trade secrets. It's never been specified exactly what they are.
Well, I would respectfully disagree. I think they are is what surrounds the use of maleic acid in a bleaching treatment in order to bring that to market. So it's kind of the trappings of that trade secret and making it into an actual product.
Are the trappings written down somewhere that we can look at in the joint appendix?
Well, the trappings, the financial some of this information was communicated orally and some in documents. The key document besides the unpublished patent application is the financials that were provided on May 19th. And while those financials are not in the record, L'Oreal's use of them is, and I can give the court a citation reference for that, 46788 to 46789. L'Oreal, what it does is it has taken those Olaplex financials and uses it in its own analysis of what to do in terms of whether to make its own product or to purchase Olaplex.
How do those financial documents reveal a trade secret? What is it about the financial documents that demonstrates the trade secret?
Because the financial documents are, number one, not publicly available, and they're concrete cost information.
Well, that's different, isn't it? Not publicly available as opposed to it constituting a trade secret.
Yes, it's not publicly available, but it's also a roadmap, as the CEO testified, to how to bring this product to market. So it is a trade secret.
So what's the roadmap?
The roadmap is here's both the invention, maleic acid and bleaching, and here also is how you're going to commercially develop it into a product and get it out on the market, which, of course, is everyone's goal. It was L'Oreal's goal. It was Olaplex's goal. And they all go together. That's why the trade secret experts valued them as a package, but they are slightly different. Financial information is a separate document from the unpublished patent application. If the court will permit me, I'll briefly, I know I'm over my time as Mr. Kinnaird was as well, and if the court will indulge me, I'd just like to say a few words about some of the other issues. First of all, I think it's important.
I have a question for you about the estoppel, okay? Suppose, just hypothetically, that in proving infringement here, you present evidence that the breakage limitation was inherent in the prior art. Would an argument that created obviousness be foreclosed by the PTAB decision since that evidence wasn't something that could have been presented to the PTAB?
Not sure I follow Your Honor's question. I apologize, because my understanding was that the inherency argument was in fact made to the PTAB, was rejected by the PTAB, and was affirmed by this court. So I do think that it was able to be raised and actually was raised and decided.
What I'm saying is there's new evidence presented by you in connection with infringement that also shows inherency. But this is a hypothetical. I'm talking about in the new trial. And the question I'm asking you is, once you've presented this new evidence and they fasten on that and say, well, this new evidence shows inherency, is that argument foreclosed by the PTAB decision, since the evidence that they would then be relying on wasn't evidence that could have been presented to the PTAB in the first place?
Well, the standard, I admit, under the statutory estoppel under 325 is could have been raised, and if they have a legitimate argument to make that they could not have raised something, then that's fine. However, on the written description issue that's at issue here, that's really just a matter of statute. That's something that could have been raised and really what written description requires is you're comparing the claims to the specification. I don't understand the L'Oreal point that it depends on some claim construction of the district court. I don't think that fits here. But even on the merits of written description, if I could just address those, we heartily disagree And the relevant pages that the court could find at 307 and et cetera of the appendix talk about one thing Mr. Kinnaird mentioned is it doesn't go up to 100%. It absolutely does. At column 18, lines 28, it talks about 20% or higher after treatment. Or higher gets you up to 100%. And we also have pointed to other passages, which I don't have time to review now, but all of the passages in the specification support those claims 14 through 16. On the exclusion of witnesses issue, very briefly, here's the point. It's not about an obligation to produce someone. What it is a precondition that if L'Oreal wants to call a witness at trial for its own case, which is what they ended up wanting to do, they cannot do that unless they satisfied the precondition of producing that person for deposition, because they obviously had control over Ms. Allard, where they're willing to fly.
Where does the order say that they have to produce them? I mean, there's no such requirement in the federal rule. You'd have to get it out of the order. Where is it in the order?
Yes, it's 6374 of the appendix. The order says that trial witnesses, that is a witness that a party wants to call at trial, has to have been deposed if the other party elected a deposition during the period. And I must correct Mr. Kinnear.
They have to produce the witness as opposed to you're going through the normal processes to get the deposition.
It's the way we interpreted it, as well as the district court, was that it's a precondition to L'Oreal being able to offer a witness. Now, if L'Oreal had not tried to offer Ms. Allard, then we're up. It's up to us to take whatever compulsory process is available to us. But this is a precondition, and it's born out of fairness. It's not fair for L'Oreal to come forward and put a witness up who they clearly have control over, because L'Oreal SA may be a different entity from L'Oreal USA, but they obviously had control because they could fly her up at a moment's notice. It's not fair for them not to, to put us through the burden of going to The Hague. We did ask in August, of the year before the trial, August 2018, Mr. Kinnaird said we didn't ask for a deposition. We absolutely did ask. They denied it. We went to the Hague request. We filed this election during the fact discovery period. They fought us. They opposed the Hague request. We showed up in Nanterre, France to take her deposition. She no-showed. They didn't give any – we had no idea she was in Brazil. That's a misstatement by Mr. Kinnaird. And so they put us through all of this trouble, all of this expense, and they also delayed us having the benefit of her deposition until very late in the case. And the district court's rule under the pretrial order is you can't do that. The sanction for that is that you cannot have that person testify you because you didn't make testify for you because you did not make that person available timely during the period. That's the basis of the order. It's not some freestanding obligation to put a witness up.
Right at the beginning of that recitation, before you got to The Hague, you said, we asked them, let's assume you meant L'Oreal USA, for a deposition of Ms. Allard. Where did you do that?
We did it in a oral communication in August 2018. It's not in the record. It was. I don't want to overstate it because it's not a document. But there was a communication where that was requested. So it wasn't like we jumped right to a Hague request.
You can't rely on something that's not in the record to support what the district court did.
Well, that's fair. I take that point, but Mr. Kinnaird said that we had not even asked in any respect, and I don't feel that that's a true statement. But I do recognize that it's not in the appellate record. We certainly did make the Hague request well within the fact discovery period, however. I want to mention one more thing, which I think is important, and that's aside from statutory estoppel, there's the doctrine of collateral estoppel under Max Linear, which Judge Dyke is authored, and other cases like the Nestle v. Steuben case. And the collateral estoppel issue here applies to independent development versus copying. The PTAB and the 419 proceeding, and then this finding was affirmed by this court, found that L'Oreal copied the unpublished patent application, did not independently develop. This court, in its most recent decision on the injunction, on the 954 patent, assumed without deciding, which of course is assumed without deciding, but that issue was argued in that case as well. And it's our position under Max Linear and Nestle that there is estoppel on the question of copying from that decision. And I have taken up much of my time, if not more. So if the court has no more questions, I will stop.
Okay, hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Weisberg. Mr. Kinnaird, you have 2 minutes.
This will be very fast. First, Dr. Borish filed no expert report on trade secrecy. He was not qualified to do that, and he did not testify to it. He didn't even testify to the full range of references that Dr. Freeman elucidated for this purpose, only to the references that were part of the obviousness combination. You saw the testimony of Mr. Schoon, 446-2425. He doesn't address specifically maleic acid. As far as these other claims, in the financial information, that they say, well, we used it to evaluate whether to acquire or do our independent development. That was permitted under the NDA. And also, their expert said at 44653 that he is not opining that we use the financials. And I'm sorry to say, but I believe that Mr. Weisberg has not accurately stated the other trade secrets. And this is addressed at 30 to 31 of our reply brief. But the testing trade secret, and there was very scant information about that at trial, but it was sensory testing of marketed products on hair tresses and salons. It was product stability testing and the non-use of silicones. Those had nothing to do with maleic acid. Those were all in relation to the Olaplex product, and none of that could have – and there was no testimony that that was used in the maleic acid development. So I think that's completely incorrect. Furthermore, on the exclusion part of it, we did not have control. We certainly had practical ability to arrange, but that's not the same as duty. They did not ask for a deposition, and we have consistently maintained that. And if they had thought that was untrue, they should have submitted a declaration in the record. This is the first time that we're hearing that. And it doesn't matter whether they knew whether she was in Brazil or not. The fact is, you know, it was an ill-conceived notion that you would try to get Allard in France when she's not present in France and can't be compelled. And even if they...
Thank you, Mr. Knaird. I think we're out of time.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank both counsel. Before we conclude, the counsel should know that the court suggests that the parties might wish, now having come up to our court four times and potentially going back for a new trial, is going back for a new trial, that the parties might consider settling this case. We're not ordering that. The court is just suggesting that it might be time to think about that. So unless my colleagues have something to add to that, hearing nothing, the case is submitted. That concludes our session for this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.